Right, let's get into it. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point Podcast UK. Today, we're here with Don. I don't know how to pronounce your surname.
It's like Guys Like Pies.
Guys Like Pies. We're here with Don Guys. And Don, you're kind of like a dating coach, aren't you? As you're like a men's empowerment.
Something to that effect. I don't like to pigeonhole myself, calling myself
That's
a dating
coach. Good idea.
Yeah. But
I rate that.
Let's call it that. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll call all round men's guidance counselor, which I guess not guidance counselor.
I'm a male training performance coach. That's a good way to put it.
Nice. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. So let's get into the first question. What is a male training performance coach, in your opinion?
Well, it's basically looking at what it means to be a man and asking yourself, what areas do I need to work on in my life? Is it my finances? Is it my health? Is it my romantic relationships? Is it my platonic relationships? Is it my emotional intelligence? Is it my spiritual intelligence? Is it my relationship to any type of trauma that I have in my life? Is it living with values? Right. So it's a very holistic sense of looking at what it means to be an actualized individual. And particularly from a man's perspective, there's different factors that are more important than, say, from a woman's perspective in terms of following a specific structure. Right. So I would say that's a long-winded way of explaining it. Yeah.
That's a good way of explaining it. That makes sense. So what are some of those facets of life that are more significant or possibly important to men than they could be to women?
Well, I would say ultimately at a specific level of consciousness, they kind of merge together. But there's more of a cultural and a societal and a biological expectation for men to be more external creatures, going out and doing things, making something happen, creating something, providing structure, providing space, providing a containment to where one can feel like they can thrive, right? Creating that sort of environment where somebody feels like they can become the person they were meant to become. As opposed to a more feminine perspective, which is more beautifying and amplifying that type of space, right? So if a feminine essence is entered, you know, it's a whole classic expression, turning a house into a home, right? Mm-hmm. You take the raw ingredients and turn it into a meal. So it's basically the amplification of making something that was already there. Now, that's the biological, fundamental, foundational imprint of how masculine and feminine energy works. But at a certain point of inner work, you realize that you have both of those polarities within inside of yourself and that you can do that yourself, irrespective of if you're a woman or a man. But I would say that because men have cultural conditioning as well as sometimes religious conditioning, and on a very strictly biological level, a higher level of testosterone and a higher desire to go out and serve, that there's that certain impulse to make that happen more so than it is for women.
Yeah, and also if you look at the world in through the lens of binary polarizations, and then the point is that the two binaries, when they rectify, is that the right word? Yeah, rectify one another, they create something that's sort of magical, and it's the rectification of those two polarities that breeds new. You know, new emerging ideas and masculinity is usually represented as order, and femininity is usually represented as chaos. And one of the reasons why I think there's a more of an impetus within men, and both societal and personal, for men to go out and to create something is because the masculine, not the male drive, but the masculine drive is to turn chaotic no man's land into something useful and beneficial for the society that they find themselves in. And
precisely.
That's like, you know, we have in England, we've got the George and the Dragon story. You know, we have St. George's Day and all these stories. St. Patrick's Day, I think, is the same. It's all the same context. It's the same concept. Masculine tackles chaos, usually some sort of reptilian beast, and then garners something of value in return. It's the Hobbit story. It's very, very much it's very much instantiated in us that it's a biological story. So that makes sense why you think that that's happening.
I'm really glad that you brought up that particular legend of slaying the dragon, because that is it's a metaphor for slaying your sexual energy. Because the whole thing about, you know, like the phallus is representative of the snake, right? And so if men are going out and they're looking at pornography, or they are losing their purpose, or they're falling to vice, or they are not holding themselves accountable with an emotionally mature, spiritually advanced brotherhood, or even just by themselves in general, they're going to fall into that chaos, right? And really the only way to go out and create that order in the world is to first order yourself. And so the most powerful energy that we have in our body is our sexual energy. So one of the big components that I have is, how are you mastering your pornographic use? You know, I haven't looked at pornography in a long time. I don't masturbate. I specifically maintain celibacy because I understand the importance of this inner alchemical process of transforming that sexual energy into making something better in the world. And so that's basically what that's talking about on an internal level, right? But I don't hear many people discussing it from that framework.
No, you're spot on. What's so impressive and powerful about these stories is that they're true and they're applicable to multiple scenarios and multiple occurrences and dilemmas, etc. So I'd never thought of it like that, actually, slaying, controlling the dragon of your sexuality and your sexual urges. It's like, I think, I'm not sure if I came up with this or I heard it somewhere. I think I heard it somewhere, but the mythological representation of a cyclops is, I think that's meant to be the representation of male sexuality, in the sense of it's like a large, lumbering thing, and it only has one eye, which means that it only can see one thing. And also, like, you know, the fact that we've got two eyes means that we can judge distance. And if you take away one of those eyes, then you can imagine that lack of judging distance is a representation of an inability to sort of judge nuance and things like that going on. It's like just this forthright thing. And I think, so I think I heard that somewhere, but that would make complete sense, like mythology and things like that.
Mythology speaks on many, many different levels. Sometimes mythology speaks on actual events that have happened. But more importantly, it speaks on the archetypal experience for humans. And the metaphors that we use to describe the way in which we interact with each other. Another analogy, actually, I had never heard of that Cyclops analogy. I really like that. I'll have to meditate on that a little bit to see what that comes up in my field. There's a really great Bible story talking about Samson, right? And the whole thing about how Samson lost his strength when, I think her name was Jezebel or something. I don't know which character, when she cut his hair. Well, I mean, obviously when they went together in a private room, they did some stuff, right? So, and then he lost his power, right? So that's another metaphor. If you have the eyes to see and you know the context behind it, you'll know that, oh, this is another explanation of losing your sexual energy and wasting it, right? It's your mojo.
Yes, it is your mojo, as Austin Powers would say. And it's the dragon of chaos is another mythological, which we've kind of already brushed on. That's the chaos, as we said, chaos is usually represented as feminine, and the dragon of chaos is like the epitomization of the negative feminine. And in the Sleeping Beauty film, the reason something like Medusa, the reason people freeze when they look at Medusa is because it's like it's a predator response. And when men, oftentimes when men, I'm sure you encountered this, when men see or consider approaching or talking to a woman that they find incredibly attractive, they freeze up. And that's like rabbit in the headlights. That's Medusa with the head of snakes that turns you into stone when you look at her. So there's all these clever things that mythology that we've kind of lost as a society, actually. I think it's really dangerous because not dangerous, but mythology. If I was thinking about this the other day, if you want to learn more about human nature, you should read mythology. It's not quite simple because you can't read it literally, but you have to, you know, read it from a sense of what way does, if I was to make of what's being said less mythological and more practical, what would its deeper meanings be?
Yeah.
So it's cool that you like mythology.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Well, I found a value in mythology as I go throughout my life. And sometimes I meditate a lot. I'll do Qigong. When I get a wild hair, I'll go out into the woods and do mushrooms and reflect on my life. And I'll come to these conclusions naturally by studying mythology or reading, or you can study people like Carl Jung, for example. Carl Jung does a great job of breaking down the meanings of these archetypes and what they mean in your life, right? And there's so much value and rich wisdom that you can get out of studying the archetypes.
Incredible.
Yeah, there's so much, and it's extremely empowering. And you can just spend years alone just studying the archetypes in your own life and get rich wisdom and value out of it. Yeah,
exactly. Let's talk about modern dating and your opinion and your experiences both, well, if possible personally, but if not, that's fine, in terms of people approaching you and what they're asking advice on.
Where do I begin? if you really want my full opinion on the matter of it, it's a crisis. I would say that there's a deliberate, systematic approach to the crisis that feels borderline conspiratorial. But even if it wasn't conspiratorial, and I err more on the side of it being conspiratorial, but we'll keep it PG here. I mean, we could go down the rabbit hole if we want, but just on a very strictly kind of logical, demonstrable perspective, it's a mess. And I made an entire almost 3.5-hour podcast visual style video breaking down exactly why we're having these issues and what we can do about it on my YouTube channel. If you ever want to sit down and listen to it, I think it's quite informative. It's just called The Full Stack Man. That's my YouTube channel. I'm thinking about changing the name because I found out that I was actually ripping off somebody else's tagline. And it messaged me personally. I'm like, I had no idea, man. So if you're watching this in the future, it'll probably be. Where do I begin? Well, I would say that there's a number of different factors that are going on. I would say it's more of a sense of we're losing what it means to be women and men. Okay. We're going through a general consciousness shift planetary wise. And there's a lot of different implications that come with the shifting of consciousness and the way in which we approach ourselves and society from that consciousness shift. There's a literal biological and chemical warfare that's going on with the increase of estrogen within society and the decrease of testosterone in general. There is a dearth of strong masculine male role models that are emotionally intelligent and have a sense of spiritual intelligence about them that can demonstrate through their actions and through their words a healthy way of approaching life. So men are turning to unhealthy examples of wounded masculine men as a way of trying to cope with having no masculine frame at all. So that's another factor to that. And then there's also the desecration of the feminine. So this amplification of promiscuity and lack of accountability for femininity, as well as this interesting dichotomy of being empowered, but also deriving power from disempowered men. Yeah. And so that's an interesting dichotomy going on. But also just the normalization of low consciousness behavior. Cussing and philandering and laziness and lack of accountability and lack of standards, lack of values, just a general overall slobification, if you will, of society as a whole. And focusing more on the immediate, myopic, individualistic, atheistic, materialistic perspective that makes us lose sight of the deeper meaning of life and of service and of connection and of a higher spiritual path that's not just based on your own gratification. So I would say from a grandiose perspective, those are the factors that are influencing why we're having these interpersonal relationships. And if there's any one of those that you feel particularly compelled to talk about, we can dive into those factors.
Yeah. I also think that there's been the subtle implementation of grand narratives recently, and particularly the narrative of the oppressive patriarchy and the notion that, you know, men are evil. And if you're a woman, this segregating people up into a victim and a predator landscape is an incredibly dangerous, based on their group, based on someone's group identity. You know, if you're on the right of politics, you're a villain, and if you're on the left of politics, you're the hero. And it doesn't matter regardless of any other aspect to you, if you fit into a oppressor category or a victim category at some point in your demographical list, you are now a good or a bad person. The notion, if you do value everything, you do value something like sex and you devalue relationships and you devalue everything, then and you say that everything is a societal construct. And if you say everything's a societal construct, then anything can be manipulated because it's all a construct. There's no deeper foundation to anything. And I think that's really dangerous.
That's right.
That's
the danger of postmodernist ideology that we're seeing in academia, is that it's this extreme plurality. It's this total relativity. Yes. And it's... there, I think Jordan Peterson said it really well, very eloquently. He said that sometimes we don't need to change things and things are perfectly fine the way that they are. Sometimes we need to look at ourselves and ask, how can we improve? And so keeping things the way they are is more of a conservative route, while challenging the status quo was more of the liberal progressive route. And yeah, this whole ideology of progressivism has what's changed child labor laws, and it's gotten rid of slavery, and it's done a lot of progress, and it's changed the dynamics in the way in which we look at the world. But an astute man, or an astute adult in general, and a conscious individual is going to be able to be non-biased and say, okay, what do we actually need to change? Is this working? If it is, let's keep it. If it's not working, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah.
And so it's important to really try to step out of that type of duality of conservatism or liberalism and really look at it from a holistic perspective of saying, should I be more liberal in my approach or should I be more conservative in my approach? And somebody that's actually interested in truth, somebody that's actually interested in being the best version of themselves will be okay with being humble, with saying, okay, I'm wrong. You know, let's look at this perspective from this way and then integrate that into my life so that I'm more conscientious of what's actually occurring, right? Rather than demonizing myself or other people.
But I suppose sometimes you run into some obstacles because it's possible. I was thinking about this. I've thought about this for a while, but it's possible that maybe we can't set up a society that is considerate of every single type of person. Like, I don't know if that is, or it would be very difficult. You'd have to have such an expansive society. And this is a problem that we've encountered. But this is the biggest problem with conservatism in some ways is that, well, there's a few, but one of them is that it leaves people get left behind and people get left out. It's the same thing with, you know, capitalism. It's, you know, a small minority sit at the top, and the most sit at the bottom, although it's not just capitalism that causes that phenomena. Pretty much everything causes that phenomena to occur. It's like a natural law almost. And the problems,
yeah,
we have to create a society, and this is where freedom and the notion of, you know, liberty and things like that, and America, I suppose, has been incredibly beneficial to the West in your forthright hard work, you know, what's the phrase?
For individuals.
Yes. Yes. But what's the American, the American dream. Yeah. The American dream. Yeah. That's kind of been,
manifest.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of ubiquitized across all of West. And that is a great example of the rectification of those two polarities. There's an element of conservatism in that, and, you know, hard work, put in structures, and then there's also an element of liberalism, which is that anyone can do it and there shouldn't be barriers in place, etc. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea where I've gone with this tangent because I don't even remember what we were talking about.
Well, we're talking about looking at structural things and how men ultimately are the ones that lead that type of structure, right? And how we bring order from chaos, right? So one of the most powerful models that I base a lot of my training on, a lot of my information on, and a lot of my life on that is shockingly not as known as it should be, and I've just become like the big poster child of it. I talk about it with everybody. Is two different models, one called spiral dynamics, and then its more advanced derivative that came from a man named Ken Wilber called the integral theory. Are you familiar with either of those models? Okay, that's no problem. I mean, most people haven't, and that's cool. And so without making this entire interview about that, basically what it is it is a way of understanding individuals' values as well as nations' values and cultures' values, and a demonstrable map showing the inevitable progress that one makes in their own life to basically grow in terms of their consciousness. Now, when I say expanding your consciousness without sounding woo-woo and hippie, essentially what I mean by that is having the capacity to see things from a grander, more holistic, inclusive perspective without marginalizing the things that are considered more backwards or less developed or less conscious. It's basically like the Russian dolls. You have the same thing, but then there's another one and then another one and another.
Fractals.
Right. So that's what I mean by expanding one's consciousness, right? It's like a fractal, right? And so, so this model is a very powerful model for understanding what motivates people, why nations behave the way they do, why people from those nations behave the way they do, how they're going to teach their children, what types of education systems they're going to have, how they're going to be valued to one another, and the inevitable conflicts that come when you juxtapose different societies with different values, systems, right? And so it's a very powerful model for understanding pretty much almost all the reasons why we have all the reasons why we have problems in today's modern day society. And it's basically a mixture of three of the following things. You have moral absolutism, which comes from a dogmatic ideology that normally comes from religion. So very strong, strict gender roles, very strong, strict sense of what's right and wrong, and a very rigid way of looking at who you should be in the world and how you should interact with society, which often turns to a sense of a value in martyrdom, postponing your own personal gain for gain in the afterlife. So you see a lot of these things from Middle Eastern societies, particularly countries that have predominantly Muslim countries. You see a lot of this in Eastern Europe with Orthodox Christianity. And then so you have that element, right? And then you have, so in the spiral dynamics model, they call that the blue. So there's a color system. Okay. Then you have the next level above that, which is orange, which comes down to the value of materialism, scientism, this idea of if it can't be measured, then it's not correct. This idea of scientific pursuit, intellectualism, higher education, higher learning, challenging these types of religious mythos. And so the value systems that they have is material gain, personal gratification, more cars, more, more, more. So they use that orange as the color to describe that. And that's more of the American type of United States ideology. And a lot of people that are in that type of perspective, they can tend towards atheism. So there is no God. It's all ridiculous. And it's not true. And if it can't be measured, then you're wrong, right? So classic like Richard Dawkins type of dude, right? Then you have, and so if you go to school in that type of society, what are they going to teach you? Well, they're going to teach you how to make money. They're going to teach you how to be a corporate slave. They're going to teach you how to do your taxes or all that stuff. That is the best education in a society that's like that. If you're in the Middle East, memorizing the Quran and following what the Quran says about what it means to be a woman or a man is the best form of education, right? And then you have more postmodernist societies, which in the spiral dynamics model uses the color green. So this is this idea of hyper-inclusivity, the corporate's bad, stop raping the earth, and we need to account for everybody, and there is no sense of hierarchy. Everybody's right, and there is no right or wrong. Morality is totally relative, and you could be whatever you want, and all these types of things. And that's more opening the heart to what's possible. And there's tragedies within that type of perspective as well. And that's where you get people in that perspective looking at blue, which is the moral absolutism, as archaic and backwards and type of problematic. Or you look at orange or the materialistic standpoint as heartless or evil or terrible, while somebody that's an orange looks at green or the postmodernist and saying, you damn hippie, talk about all these things, you crazy person, and yet you have a Apple computer and spend $7 at Starbucks, right? You know. So essentially, East, and then there's more different levels within this hierarchy. And then above green, you have something called yellow, which is more of a holistic standpoint of, okay, how do we rectify these situations together? We're not going to change people's perspectives, but how do we create structures or systems that amplify and elevate the well-being of everybody without changing their perspectives? Right. And so that was getting back to the whole question that you had initially, the reason why I brought this up. How do we do this? How do we actually create a society where everybody is lifted up, everybody is benefited, everybody can be, everybody can feel safe and honored and respected within their own framework or paradigm without being vampiristic on other people's perspectives? And ultimately, it all boils down to inner work, knowledge, and knowing yourself and seeing the value in becoming the greatest version of yourself. Ultimately, that's literally what it all boils down to. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? What is my highest good? And what can I do about it? And in my mind, that is an actualized man, leading with that type of conscious, open-hearted purpose on a daily basis and leading with that type of integrity and inspiring other men to do so. Because ultimately, you become extremely magnetic when you look at the world from that lens. Yeah.
Powerful stuff. Yeah, I like that. So, yeah, that was a good sales pitch. So, if based on that, you make the conscious or the unconscious assumption then that there's a higher level of being that we're all capable of achieving. Would that be right? That's something that you believe is possible. Okay. And do you think it's possible to create a society where, because I was thinking about this the other day, once again, I don't think I came up with it, but it just came to me. The thing about making your own light shine brighter is that it makes the shadows of others around you appear darker. And if other people aren't interested in, not even interested is the wrong term, they feel they're incapable, they feel resentful, they feel angry, they're sad, they're suffering from an array of conditions, and they don't feel they can increase the strength of their light. How do we rectify that, and how do you think we can help those people that don't feel they can strengthen their light so that their shadows don't appear as dark as they may?
That's an awesome question. I love it.
Thank you.
So I'm going to use the same analogy of light and shadow. When you have a light and you go into a dark room, what happens?
Yeah.
The room is illuminated, right? And so that is the nature of light. And it's also the nature of truth.
Yes.
There's a specific frequency to truth that when somebody speaks truth, there's a sense of grounded conviction when they speak. This is where we get the whole idea of being charismatic, right? The charisma literally means like a spirit. So when you see somebody that's charismatic, you feel their energy and you're like, wow, that person is speaking from truth and it feels good. It resounds in your body so deeply to where you're moved, sometimes to tears or sometimes to action or sometimes to joy, right? And so the cool part is that an aspect of natural law that I've sort of come to the conclusion is that one person that's fully living in their own power and in their own truth outweighs, I don't know, let's make up a number, 100 people that are living in darkness.
Nice.
Because most people are wanting to be led. We've been conditioned into following orders. We've been conditioned into not using our minds. We've been conditioned into living in fear and living in scarcity. When if you can step outside of yourself and look at how everything is, we live in a reality of total abundance all the time. But what's happened is that we have systems and structures that have been put onto us and conditioned within our subconscious minds to believe that we live in a reality of scarcity. And that's simply not the case. And that when somebody is able to demonstrate through their actions and through their words that, you know, you've been socially conditioned into believing a lot of these things, people can then start to see that, oh, wow, okay, that's true. That may or may not be true. But if you have 100 people and you have 25% of them living in darkness, but the other 75% of them are living in their fullest, highest power, you're never going to have to worry about that 25% of people, because ultimately that 75% of people is going to keep that 25% in check. And whether they decide to behave destructively or not, it's not going to affect the majority of people. Right. And so the good news that keeps me sane is that people that are doing the work that I do by encouraging other men to be the greatest version of themselves, we don't need to actually change everybody's lives. I mean, yeah, ideally that would be great. We only need to light the spark in just a few amount of people. So with your work, with what you're doing, perhaps somebody's going to come across this podcast and I'll never meet them in my life, but maybe something that I say sparks something inside of themselves where they go out and they make a difference, right? And that one person is going to make the difference in 500 people's lives. And that's all that matters, right? So the answer to your question is that there's an asymmetrical relationship to the light and to the darkness, and that we only need a specific number of people that are living in that full truth to be able to reach the 100 monkey syndrome so that we shift and tip the scales of our consciousness on a global level.
Yeah.
But the reason why we don't do that is because we don't value doing that. We don't see that stepping outside of ourselves will actually make the world such a better place, and that everybody's thinking about these things But it's really about, okay, how do we take these systems? How do we take this technology? How do we take these structures? How do we take these ideas and implement them in our lives and then show other people the value of implementing these on a daily basis? It's by living. Yeah. It's by living your actions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's how you do it, man. Yeah. One conversation at a time, one transformed life at a time, one video at a time, one podcast at a time, every single day, normalizing this type of conversation and combating the crap that's on the radio. Combating the crap that's on the TV, combating the crap that's in the higher education that's emasculating men and demonizing, you know, like making women crazy and all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how you do it. But with integrity and love and presence and emotional availability.
Right? Yeah. We also make the assumption, I think, nowadays that we're completely disconnected from one another and there's no, like, I 100% believe that when you spread helpful, good, beneficially motivated ideas or occurrences or acts or behaviors, it does make the world a better place. And we are all connected. And if someone is suffering out in the world is a worse place for it. And we don't just exist in a self vacuum or even a familial vacuum or even a, you know, societal vacuum. I do believe that we're all, you know, a drop in the ocean. And there's, you know, the collective unconscious and the collective conscious, there's been various incredible thinkers throughout the past who have sort of hinted at that notion of thinking that we're all, you know, it sounds very, as you said a little bit earlier, it sounds very hippie and fantastical and the idea that we're all connected. But I do believe the world is a worse place when people don't actualize themselves to the absolute peak that they possibly could. And I'm sure, or I reckon that's something that you believe in as well to some degree, given what you're doing and everything. So that's...
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. That, and so at that level, it doesn't become about how much money you make. It doesn't become about how well off your family is. Those are very important factors that should not be dismissed. But what I find is that when I feel like I'm not motivated, I look at myself in the mirror and say, it's your duty to be the best man that you can be. Because if you're not doing that, you're doing the world a disservice. That doesn't mean that I think that I'm some amazing, honorable, wonderful person. It just means to say that, like, if you're not going to do it, then who else is going to do it? Right? And if you can't lead yourself, then why will people follow? If you can't lead yourself, then how can you lead a family? If you can't lead yourself, then how can you fix the problems in the world?
Yeah.
So you have a moral obligation to do the best that you can.
Yes. Right? And also, you know, it's all very easy to look at these, what we're talking about, and say, oh yeah, whatever, guys, when things are okay. But the thing is when things fall apart, if those structures haven't been built up, haven't been cultivated underneath, then when they fall apart, they really fall apart. And the more you're built on lies and you're built on deception and you're built on behaviors that you find unadmirable and detrimental to you and the people around you, the more and more you're a combination and an amalgamation of them. You can get away with it when things are okay, maybe, kind of, sort of. But then when things get difficult, which they will for everyone, regardless of if that's on a daily basis or a bi-weekly basis or whatever time frame you want to take it and to whatever level of intensity, you do the work, not even, maybe work's the wrong word, but you do the self-reflection and the self-actualization in preparation for the dark days. You brighten your light so that if you do end up in a dark room, you can make it bright for everyone else, I think.
That's right. Precisely. I really like the quote, truth fears no inquiry. Mm-hmm. And so if you're living with principles and on a daily basis, you're living high-minded values, what you have to fall back on are your values. Your values are the foundation which compels you to go out in the world and make the right decisions. Some people may value comfort. Guess what? You're going to sit around and jerk off to porn and drink beer and watch football. You know? But if you value excellence, you're not going to do those kinds of things. And when you've built that foundation, you develop a network, you develop skills, you develop behaviors that will get you out of that hole. Yeah. That's why it's really hard when people haven't built their lives up on good, solid foundations and morals and values, and that when they do inevitably fall, they really have to dig deep because they don't have anything to fall back on. They have to look at themselves in the mirror and say, the only person I have to fall back on is myself.
And I didn't even know where to start, which is even makes it even worse.
Well, I think it's also good to have a relationship to a higher power, right? I'm not going to proselytize about any particular religion because I don't necessarily subscribe rigidly to any particular type of religion. I was raised Catholic and I resonate most with the values that come from Christianity, but I've gotten a lot of values from so many different teachings. I read the Quran last year and there was some great stuff in that. I deeply studied Hermeticism and I used to live in China and I studied under monks of Taoism and wow. Buddhism and Neoplatonism and all those types of things. And if you look at it from like a perspective, the core foundation of it is the values, the value systems, yes. and a relationship to a higher power. So if you want to call that Jesus, you want to call that God, you want to call that consciousness, you want to call that Allah, you want to call that the Tao. I don't want to, without getting too much into the weeds of what's what and who's who within the religious dogma, the point that I'm getting at is relying on a higher power. And the way that I look at that is my higher self, which is ultimately the spark or the aspect that comes from the Godhead itself. The consciousness that is within Dawn that is experiencing the temporary physical reality of Dawn. And that voice is always going to give you the right answer. And it's about silencing the egoic mind and listening to that higher mind and following that higher mind, even if you don't necessarily agree with it or like what it's going to tell you. And when we have cultivated that type of relationship with that higher power, if we're doing it correctly, we start to realize that, oh, wow, I come from that source of consciousness. I am that source of consciousness. And I return to that source of consciousness. Then if that's the truth, and I'm not saying that that's the truth, you can come to your conclusion that self, that's how I understand it to be true. If you come to that conclusion yourself, what most people inevitably come to is, why would I be afraid to live? Why would I be afraid to act correctly out in the world when I know that that's where I come from? And so what that does is that allows us to separate ourselves from the egoic story that we tell ourselves. I am this person. I am this traumatized person. I'm a victim. I'm this. Oh, how horrible. And it's these layer upon layer upon layer of trauma that gives our ego a reason to exist and make a story up out in the world. And until we actually turn within and say, okay, how do I change the story of myself to interact with the world? That's where you really start shifting your mindset from I'm a victim to the external world, which psychologists call the external locus of control, to your internal focus, which is what psychologists call your internal locus of control, saying that my internal thoughts, my internal actions ultimately change the environment that's around me. I would say that there's aspects of both to it. And then changing your perspective of, okay, how can I take control? How can I take radical responsibility for my own life and my own actions to change the well-being of my life? That's true masculinity, right? I would say that that's true actualization, but that's the masculine framework that is in men and women. And then getting to a point of, okay, well, I mean, this is still just a story that I'm telling myself. Ultimately, it's all just pure one consciousness. And And I'm just pretending to play the story. I'm just going to make the best character myself, but ultimately it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a great Buddhist quote that says, polish the diamond as brightly as you can.
Yes.
And realize that there is no diamond.
There is no diamond.
Oh, yes.
Polish the diamond as brightly as you can and realize that there is no diamond.
Very, very good. Yes. Yeah.
And so that's the whole point, right? To do the best that you can, but realize it doesn't really matter. We're all just here as a consciousness, as a spirit, temporarily inhabiting a physical existence to learn what love is through duality.
What do you mean through duality?
That's literally everybody. Good, bad, hot, okay. Cold, up, down, black, white. I like this. I don't.
Yeah.
Right. And coming to understand truth through duality.
Yes. And possibly learning that.
That's it.
Yeah. No, you're right. You are right. And also possibly learning that that's the middle ground between the duality and the polarity is where all the magic happens. You know, that's kind of like exactly. What the term flow state use was thrown around a lot, particularly like 5 or 6 years ago. You know, loads of people were trying to sell courses of how to get people into the flow state. And I feel like the flow state is a representation of what Jordan Peterson would talk when he talks about the perfect balance of chaos and order. And I think the flow state is where, as he would say, you have some knowledge of some of the task at hand, but you're also pushing yourself in a way that is unknown. And it's the polarities and the coming together of those two polarities within multiple contexts and across multiple polarities, that is what we're kind of looking for. And that's where, as I said a little minute ago, the magic happens, I think.
Yeah, that's the grander perspective of why we're all here, ultimately. That's literally everybody's like, what's my purpose? I'm like, that's your purpose. That's why you're here. And you have a specific framework as to how you're going to approach that. You could come from England. You could come from Afghanistan. You could come from a very religious background. You could come from a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
But regardless of what types of cards you've been dealt, ultimately that is your end goal.
Mm.
To figure out who you are, to figure out what love is, and to overcome whatever's been dealt to you. And be the best version of yourself so that we can bring about a better reality.
Yeah. And also,
it's really that simple.
Don't
really degrade. That easy.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also, don't degrade your own sort of individualistic and idiosyncratic experiences, because those are what you are meant to use as the structure to, or the need that is meant, that needs to be filled. That's what you're supposed to use those experiences as the fuel to partake in that manifestational, that's not a word, but the what you just described, partake in that activity. Yeah. So don't degrade them.
Yeah. Well, Ollie, that's another form of the duality. You have the individualism and you have the collectivism.
Yes, yeah.
Right? The individual's actions in the aggregate ultimately creates the difference in the world.
Yes.
When, you know, I come from the United States and we are the most hyper-individualistic country on the planet. And, you know, are you familiar with the Gert Hofstede model by any chance? Oh, man. If you're like a culture junkie, you'll love this. Gert Hofstede. He was a Dutch professor or something like that. It's a model for understanding a different cultural value systems. So you have individualism versus collectivism. You have power dynamics. Is it more equal, or are there very rigid hierarchies? Are you more short term, or are you more long term oriented? Right. So there's different metrics for measuring different cultural conditionings and understandings. And so the balance is trying to see the value in the individual, but to influence the collective, if you come from a collectivist society, there generally is not really a push to innovate.
Yes.
Because there's you want to step in your box. It's about order. It's about not shaking things up. And you normally get a lot of that type of legalistic perspective from Confucianism. So Confucianism was a very rigid, in the Analects, actually the Analects over there. So you had two different theories and philosophies of spirituality during that time within China, which was Taoism or Taoism, and then you have Confucianism. So Confucianism is more of like the legalistic perspective, do this and don't do this. And Taoism is more along the lines of the flow and the creativity. It's sort of like from Christianity, looking at it from the Old Testament versus the Holy Spirit in the New Testament. Yeah. It's like there's two different types of philosophies. They're both right in and of themselves, but you need both to harmonize it,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And so the mastery of the individual influences the collective.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same way we have two hemispheres of our brain. It's because there are two ways of seeing, perceiving the world, and it's the, I believe it's called the corpus callosum, which mediates between the two hemispheres is...
Right. The orbital corpus.
Yeah. That's the point. It's the world is made up of binaries and polarities, and it's the rectification of those things that creates the way we see the world. Right, let's stop there on that topic, because I want to ask you, I want to dial it down on the intensity a little bit and just go into, I want to talk about like what people, let's talk about porn and let's talk about what men are, what's happening and in that, from that perspective, and what you're hearing and what you're learning and what you think about the whole porn, OnlyFans, sort of devaluing of sexuality and red pill incels, the whole everything.
All of it.
Yeah.
So, man.
Sum it up in a sentence. No, I'm joking. Yeah.
My goodness.
Go.
Well, I will go down with the principle of ye shall know them by their fruits. Let's look at somebody that consistently, regularly utilizes porn. Let's see how high their confidence level is. Let's see how many girlfriends they have. Let's see how healthy their relationship with their sexuality is. Let's see their testosterone levels. Let's see how much of an impact in the world they're making.
Mm.
Right? That's it. You shall know them by their fruits. And there's a middle path. If you shame sexuality too much, if you fear sexuality too much, you're not going to see the values and the benefits of it. But if you abuse sexuality, you're going to overripen the fruit of sexuality. So if you want to look at things from a strictly biological perspective, the most recent statistics show that almost 100% of men have used or do currently use pornography.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, there's a very similar statistic for women as well. And what happens when we expose our brains to pornography is that we overflood our brains with dopamine. And we also systematically destroy the gray matter that's in our brains. So the gray matter in our brains is what's responsible for higher order thinking. So your ability to cognate on higher levels, your ability to make more complex decisions, your ability to think more rationally rather than reactively. And if we are destroying the gray matter of our brains consistently, we are quite literally becoming retarded in our brains, quite literally. And if you look at people that have been exposed to copious amounts of trauma, particularly people that have gone through a lot of military training, if you look at the CAT scan of their brain before they started training versus after they started the training, there's a higher trend of the loss of gray matter in their brains because they don't want people thinking about, oh, should I shoot this person or not? No, they say, I want you to shoot this person. You're going to shoot this person. Don't think about another one, right? So that's just a little tangent, but So utilizing pornography destroys the gray matter of our brains. It also weakens our pelvic floor muscles. So it increases the likelihood of premature ejaculation, or basically an inability for us to control the flow of the sexual energy coming in and out of our bodies. And it also taxes our dopamine system. And so sex for men is the most rewarding thing that we can have. And if we are tricking our brains into thinking that the thing that we're looking at is ultimately the reward that we get from having sex, we are going to lose our motivation to actually go out and procreate. We're going to lose our motivation to go out and create things in the world when looking at pornography, or just masturbating in general, but especially looking at pornography. That's basically already subconsciously telling us that you've got the reward. Good job. You've been rewarded for doing nothing, right? And so that weakens men's motivation. It weakens men's drive to go out and talk to women. And men that use copious amounts of pornography, that heightens their approach anxiety. Almost every single man that I've talked to that has approach anxiety almost inevitably utilizes pornography regularly. There's a direct correlation with that. So there's that factor. Then there has to do with the factor of the importance and the significance of seminal fluid. Semen is an extremely interesting chemical within our body. It has a very high level of plasma. And so plasma is what helps our blood, it helps our body, it helps rejuvenate ourselves. Semen has very high levels of vitamin and mineral contents. But if you look at it from more of like a holistic perspective, what is semen? Well, semen is the liquid that creates life. And so naturally, we have a biological impulse to create life. We're not going to give the worst of our bodies when we're creating children. Obviously, we want to carry on the best genes that we can, and our bodies are going to give the very best that we can.
Yeah.
And so the Taoists believe that when you're about to ejaculate, it tells your body, okay, it's time to create a life. It's time to create a child. So what happens is that all of your organs, your brain, your kidneys, your liver, your heart, all of these things compress the energy of that within the seminal fluid. And they say, okay, it's time to give the very best that my body has to create this life. And then you shoot it out to create that life. And that's why every single man, after they ejaculate, they collapse, right? Because you're getting rid, quite literally, of the best energy that you got. Think about that. If you're constantly jacking off three times a day, looking at pornography, and you are getting rid of literally the best that your body's got, obviously you're going to feel like crap. Obviously you're going to be depressed. Obviously you're going to be tired, right?
Yeah.
And you got paused for a second, but yeah, so the brain doesn't differentiate between if you're jerking off a bunch of pixels on a screen or if you're making a baby. There's not like okay, God's doing the porn switch now. Let's shoot the bad stuff out and keep the good stuff. No, it's just like it's all the same.
Is it the different parts of the brain? One part of the brain can understand and another part of the brain can't understand the differentiation between reality and between sort of a artificial experience?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good question. I think that this boils down to a more metaphysical question.
Okay.
From more of like a mystical perspective. So I've spent a good number of years studying different lineages of mysticism and what that means, and which mysticism basically means understanding the demonstrable scientific mechanics of consciousness and how it interfaces with reality.
Damn.
So if you look at things from a mental perspective, mystics would say that thinking thoughts is the fourth dimensional reality. It is fourth or fifth dimensional reality. So it's the interface between the physical potentiality and the actual potentiality itself.
Nice, yeah.
So there's a number of different factors that are going into your particular question. I think first and foremost, the reason why there's that division or that separation is just simply ignorance, right? We don't, people are generally ignorant of the cause and effect of their behaviors, mm-hmm. right? Everything is cause and effect. If you do something, it's going to either be a positive outcome for you, a neutral outcome for you, or a negative outcome for you.
Yeah.
But irrespective, there is going to be an outcome. And if we think about something in our minds, what that's doing is that's collapsing a potentiality into your mind that if it's held in your mind's eye enough, eventually it's going to become a physicality. And this, the pop psychology around this is law of attraction.
Mm.
But I don't like to use that word particularly because I think that's highly, highly misunderstood and actually quite dangerous
yeah.
to look at that from that perspective. But from more of a mystical consciousness perspective, thinking and imagining things is taking raw potentiality and formulating it in your brain, and then ultimately through your actions, carrying out that reality.
Yeah.
And I think that the discrepancy that you're describing is that there's a difference between the fantasy that's within the brain versus the reality that's in the three-dimensional plane.
Yeah.
And it's easy to escape into fantasy.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't require you to do something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's yeah. that.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, that did. Yeah, that did. And that, I think that relates back to the Carl Jung that we were speaking about, who was obsessed with fantasy and the importance of fantasy and things like that, and mythology and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think that, and also it's, I think that completes the podcast full circle as well, because we started off talking about turning chaos into order sort of physically.
Yeah.
And now we've just spoken about it mentally. So I think that's a good mm-hmm. place to stop, Don.
Yeah, sounds good, man.
Brilliant. Thank you. Have you got any questions? You got any final remarks that you want to say? I know that's a random question, but any? No? Okay. Perfect. No.
Well, I can see a couple of concluding thoughts. I want to thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
Thank you for coming
on. I want to thank you for what you're doing and going out there and seeking people that are making a difference in the world,
yes,
and
yeah.
sharing encouraging and uplifting information. You are a great example to how other men should be. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you. You too.
And just for anybody that's, yeah, thank you. And for anybody that's watching this, if this resonates with you, just realize that everything that we've discussed on this podcast is you as well. We're talking about an aspect of you, and that ultimately any type of fulfillment that you want to have in your life, any type of transformation that you want to have in your life, all starts with you, and you have the resources and you have the tools. All you have to do is go out and seek it, and seek and you shall find, and then consistently through your actions, make that reality happen. And then on the other side of whatever darkness you're experiencing is so much tremendous empowerment and love and truth and light. You just have to realize that that exists, and that's there for you when you decide to take the plunge and become the man or woman that you are meant to be.
Perfect.
That's what I got.
Couldn't have surmised a blueprint for life better if I tried. I think that was perfect.